But the pact was doomed to failure, as again differences between Malik, Masud and Khalili prevented the Uzbeks, Tajiks and Hazaras from working together. At the root of the split was the other leader's suspicions of Malik after his string of betrayals. Malik had been unable to prevent a force of some 2,500 Taliban, who had remained behind in the north, from capturing the city of Kunduz, which had an airport. The Taliban reinforced this enclave with daily flights of men and materials from Kabul. While Malik could not or would not drive the Taliban out of the north, Masud was moving closer to Kabul. In mid-July, Masud broke the military stalemate north of Kabul by recapturing Charikar and the Bagram airbase, killing hundreds more Taliban troops. By September, Masud's forces were once again positioned only 20 miles from Kabul. Both sides traded artillery and rocket bombardments, which forced nearly 180,000 civilians to flee the lush Shamali Valley, just north of Kabul and now on the front line. As the Taliban retreated from the Shamali, they poisoned water wells and blew up small irrigation channels and dams in a bid to ensure that the local Tajik population would not return in a hurry. The war was now not just uprooting and killing civilians, but destroying their very means of livelihood and turning Kabul's agricultural belt into a wasteland. The anti-Taliban alliance had now created a huge 180-degree arc that surrounded Kabul. To the west and north of the city were Masud's forces, while to the east and south were Khalili's Hazaras. As speculation mounted that they may launch an attack on Kabul, the Taliban remained confident that the opposition was too divided to attack Kabul. "We have divided the opposition into two parts by putting our forces into Kunduz. The northern groups are disunited against each other. The other Uzbek generals cannot rely on Malik. He's already betrayed them once, and now he's just trying to save himself. No group has enough forces to fight the Taliban on their own, so they have to try and unite, but they can never unite," said Haqqani. Doubts about Malik's loyalty to the alliance appeared to be justified when, in September, the Taliban force in Kunduz took him by surprise. The Taliban broke out of their Kunduz enclave and, with the help of Pashtun tribes in the area, launched another attack on Mazar. On the 7th of September 1997, they captured the town of Tashkogan, creating panic in Mazar. As the Taliban advanced on Mazar, heavy fighting broke out between Uzbek troops loyal to Malik and others loyal to Dostum. Malik's house was burnt down by Dostum's troops, and he fled to his base in Faryab province and then escaped to Turkmenistan, from where he went on to Iran. In a dramatic turnaround, Dostum returned to Mazar from exile in Turkey and rallied his troops to defeat Malik's supporters and push the Taliban out of the Mazar region. Mazar descended into chaos as the Uzbeks again looted parts of the city and the offices of UN aid agencies, forcing humanitarian aid workers to abandon Mazar for the second time in a year. As the Taliban retreated, they massacred at least 70 Shia Hazaras in Kazilabad, a village south of Mazar, and perhaps hundreds more. The Taliban swept through this village like storm. They killed about 70 people. Some had their throats slit while others were skinned alive, said Sohrab Rostam, a survivor of the massacre. With the Taliban retreating back to Kunduz, Dostum tried to consolidate his position, but Mazar was now virtually taken over by Hazara groups, and Dostum was forced to abandon the Uzbek capital and set up his base in Shibergan. Acute tensions between the Uzbeks and the Hazaras undermined the anti-Taliban alliance, and Dostum still had to win over Malik's supporters. He did so by exposing the atrocities committed by Malik. Dostum's troops unearthed 20 mass graves near Shibargan in the Dasht-e-Laili desert in Juzjan province, where more than 2,000 Taliban prisoners of war had been massacred and buried. Dostum accused Malik of the massacres, offered the Taliban help to retrieve the bodies, and called in the UN to investigate. He released some 200 Taliban prisoners as a gesture of goodwill. Subsequent UN investigations revealed that the prisoners had been tortured and starved before dying. The manner of their death was horrendous. Prisoners were taken from detention, told they were going to be exchanged, and then trucked to wells often used by shepherds, which held about 10 to 15 metres of water. They were thrown into the wells, either alive or, if they resisted, shot first and then tossed in. Shots were fired and hand grenades were exploded into the well before the top was bulldozed over, said UN Special Rapporteur Paik Chong-hyun, who inspected the graves. Later there were eyewitness reports, which made it clear that vicious ethnic cleansing had taken place. At night, when it was quiet and dark, we took about 150 Taliban prisoners, blindfolded them, tied their hands behind their backs, and drove them in truck containers out to the desert. We lined them up, 10 at a time, in front of holes in the ground, and opened fire. It took about 6 nights, said General Salim Sahar, an officer loyal to Malik, who had been arrested by Dostum. The use of containers was particularly horrific, and they were to be used increasingly as a method of killing by both sides. When we pulled the bodies out of the containers, their skin was burned black from the heat and the lack of oxygen, said another of Malik's generals, who added that 1,250 Taliban had died a container death. The catastrophe in the north and the heavy fighting that followed through the summer only further widened the ethnic divide in Afghanistan between the Pashtun Taliban and the non-Pashtuns. The country was now virtually split along north-south lines, and also along Pashtun and non-Pashtun lines. All sides had carried out ethnic cleansing and religious persecution. The Taliban had massacred Shia Hazara villagers and forced out Tajik farmers from the Shumali Valley. The Uzbeks and Hazaras had massacred hundreds of Taliban prisoners and killed Pashtun villagers in the north and around Kabul. The Shia Hazaras had also forced out Pashtuns on the basis of their Sunni beliefs. More than 750,000 people have been displaced by the recent fighting, in the north, around Mazar, on the Herat front, and around Kabul, creating a new refugee crisis at a time when UN agencies were trying to persuade refugees still living in Pakistan to return home. Moreover, the divisions inside Afghanistan were manipulated and exacerbated by its neighbours, as all countries stepped up aid to their various Afghan proxies. This only worsened the ethnic and sectarian divide. Apart from the suffering civilians, the biggest casualty of the stepped-up fighting was the UN. The UN mediator, Norbert Hall, failed to persuade the Taliban that the UN was a neutral peace broker, or the opposition that the UN would protect the interests of the ethnic minorities. Nor was Hall able to put pressure on regional countries to stop arming the factions. Nobody trusted the UN, and everyone ignored it. Hall made a blunt statement, blaming outside powers for continued interference and the inflexibility of the belligerents. "We have a standstill in the negotiating process. We just cannot continue business as usual. I do not see the Afghan leaders as puppets, but they need to get ammunition from somewhere," Hall said. A month later, Hall had resigned. The Taliban leadership, unversed in UN procedures and even the UN Charter, proved to be the greatest obstacle. Mullah Omar refused to meet Hall, creating resentment within the UN team, while other Taliban leaders publicly mocked UN efforts at promoting a ceasefire. Taliban resentment against the UN increased after the debacle in Mazar, and more so after the UN Security Council refused to take action against the Mazar massacres or hand over Afghanistan's seat at the UN, which was still occupied by President Rabbani. The Taliban harboured several unrealistic suspicions about the UN, which no amount of diplomacy could dispel. They were convinced that the UN, in league with Western powers, was conspiring against Islam and their imposition of Sharia law. They also accused the UN of being influenced by regional countries in blocking recognition of their government. The crisis within the UN came at a time when it faced dwindling funds from wealthy donor countries for aid programs because of donor fatigue over the continuing war. Donations were decreasing further because of the Taliban's discrimination against Afghan women. The future survival of aid operations in Afghanistan depended on the UN agencies convincing the Taliban to moderate their gender policies, which the Taliban refused to do. Several Western non-governmental organizations, NGOs, halted their programs in Kabul because of the Taliban's refusal to let them continue helping women. In the north, the fighting had forced the NGOs to pull out twice, and they did not return. Moreover, Taliban hardliners were doing their utmost to promote a crisis with UN humanitarian aid agencies so that they could kick them out of Taliban-held areas, under the pretext that the agencies were imparting Western secular ideas to the population. At the end of September, heads of three UN agencies in Kandahar were ordered to leave the country after they protested that a female lawyer for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, was forced to talk to Taliban officials from behind a curtain so her face would not be visible. In November, the UNHCR suspended all its programs when the Taliban arrested four UNHCR Afghan staff. Save the Children shut down several programs because the Taliban refused to allow women to participate in mine awareness classes. It was becoming impossible to provide humanitarian aid to the population anywhere, even though winter was approaching and there were growing food shortages. The Taliban's treatment of women drew enormous adverse publicity and international criticism when Emma Bonino, the European Commissioner for Humanitarian Affairs, and 19 Western journalists and aid workers were arrested and held for 3 hours by the Taliban religious police in Kabul on the 28th of September 1997. They had been touring a female hospital ward, funded by the European Union, the EU, when journalists accompanying Bonino were arrested for taking photographs of women patients. All photography was banned by the Taliban. "This is an example of how people live here in a state of terror," Miss Bonino told reporters in Kabul. The Taliban apologized, but Western enthusiasm for funding aid to Afghanistan was dealt another blow. The Taliban then declared that they would segregate Kabul's hospitals and not allow women to be treated together with men, and there was only one women's hospital in the city. It was now becoming difficult for the Clinton administration to maintain its initial sympathy for the Taliban. Powerful US feminist groups lobbied Washington on behalf of Afghan women. In November, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright issued the harshest criticism of the Taliban ever made by the US. "We are opposed to the Taliban because of their opposition to human rights and their despicable treatment of women and children and great lack of respect for human dignity," Albright said on a visit to Islamabad on the 18th of November 1997. Her statement was seen as a significant indicator of the US distancing itself both from the Taliban and Pakistan's support for them. Yet the Taliban appeared not in the least concerned about these international pressures, and in fact generated greater anti-Western feeling. The ulema in Pakistan and Kandahar told Omar that he should throw all aid agencies out of Afghanistan because they were spies and the enemies of Islam. In a bid to energize UN mediation, Secretary-General Kofi Annan ordered Lakhdar Brahimi, a former Algerian foreign minister, to tour the region and present a report to the UN Security Council. After visiting 13 countries, including Afghanistan, between the 14th of August and the 23rd of September, Brahimi's conclusions were to mobilize greater international pressure on Afghanistan's neighbors to stop aiding the belligerents. In October, Annan had set up a group of concerned countries at the UN. The group, nicknamed 6 plus 2, included six of Afghanistan's neighbours, Russia and the United States. Brahimi hoped that this forum would encourage Iran to talk to Pakistan as well as re-engage Washington in a search for peace. Another aim was to implement an arms embargo on Afghanistan and to start talks between the Afghan factions. Annan followed up these steps in mid-November with a blistering report on Afghanistan to the UN Security Council, in which for the first time he used uncompromisingly tough language, accusing regional countries, especially Iran and Pakistan, of fomenting the conflict. He said these states were using the UN as a fig leaf to continue providing aid to the factions. "Foreign, military materiel and financial support continues unabated, fueling this conflict and depriving the warring factions of a genuine interest in making peace," Annan said. "The continued support by these outside forces, combined with the apathy of others not directly involved, is rendering diplomatic initiatives almost irrelevant." Neither did Annan spare the warlords. The Afghan leaders refused to rise above their factional interests and start working together for national reconciliation. Too many groups in Afghanistan, warlords, terrorists, drug dealers and others, appear to have too much to gain from war and too much to lose from peace. Later, in Tehran, Annan addressed the summit meeting of the Organization of the Islamic Conference, the OIC, and bluntly criticized their apathy in trying to resolve the conflict. After years of neglect, Afghanistan now appeared to feature on the international diplomatic agenda. But that did little to satisfy the Taliban, who were determined to conquer the north, and their opponents, who were equally determined to resist them. Chapter 5. Bamiyan, 1998-2000. The Never-Ending War. In the Hazarajat, the country of the Hazaras in central Afghanistan, the temperature was below freezing. Under the shadows of the towering, snow-covered peaks of the Hindu Kush mountains that surround Bamiyan, Hazara children, with extended stomachs and rake-thin features, played their version of a cops and robbers game they called Taliban. The Hazaras were starving, and the game involved ambushing a Taliban convoy of wheat and bringing it home to their hungry families. The children were living on roots, berries, and a few potatoes their parents managed to grow in tiny, stony fields dug out from the sides of the steep valleys. Only 10% of the Hazarajat is cultivable, and that year's harvests of wheat and maize had failed. But the Hazaras were also starving simply for who they were. Since August 1997, in a bid to force them to surrender, the Taliban had closed all the roads from the south, west and east that entered their mountain fastness. There was no relief possible from the north, where the breakdown of law and order, the shortage of foodstuffs and the mountain passes closed by winter snow made it impossible for food convoys to travel to Bamiyan, which is situated at a height of 7,500 feet. 300,000 Hazaras in the province of Bamiyan were already hungry, while another 700,000 in the three neighbouring provinces of Gor, Wardak and Ghazni were also suffering from shortages, 1 million people in all. For months, the UN and its sister organisation, the World Food Programme, the WFP, had been holding tortuous negotiations with the Taliban to allow relief convoys through, but the Taliban had refused. The UN were even more frustrated with the fact that Pakistan had contracted to provide the Taliban with 600,000 tons of wheat, but had made no humanitarian demand on the Taliban to lift their blockade on Bamiyan. It was the first time in the past 20 years of conflict that one faction had used food as a weapon of war against another, and it demonstrated the escalation in the ethnic and sectarian divisions that were consuming Afghanistan. The Hazaras had always been at the short end of the Pashtun stick, but never to such an extent. These short, stocky people, with their distinctive Mongol features, were, according to one theory, the descendants of intermarriage between Genghis Khan's Mongol warriors and the indigenous Tajik and Turkic peoples. In 1222, Genghis Khan's grandson was killed by Bamiyan's defenders, and in revenge he massacred the population. For 1,000 years before that, Bamiyan was the centre of Buddhism in India and an important serai, or resting place for the camel caravans on the ancient Silk Route, which linked the Roman Empire with Central Asia, China and India. Bamiyan remained the protector and capital of Buddhism for the whole of Central Asia and India after the Islamic conquests. A Korean monk, Hui Chao, who arrived in the town in 827 AD, wrote that the king of Bamiyan was still a Buddhist, and it was not until the 11th century that the Ghaznavids established Islam in the valley. The town is still dominated by two magnificent 2nd century AD Buddha colossi, carved into a sandstone cliff face. The two statues, one 165 feet high, the other 114 feet high, are weathered and cracked, while the faces of both the Buddhas are missing, but their impact is stunning. The figures are carved with the classical features of all subcontinental Buddhas, but the figures are draped in Greek robes, for they represented the unique fusion of classical Indian and Central Asian art with Hellenism, introduced by the armies of Alexander the Great. The Buddhas were one of the wonders of the ancient world, visited by pilgrims from China and India. Thousands of Buddhist monks once lived in the caves and grottos carved into the cliffs alongside the statues. These caves, covered with antique stuccos, were now home to thousands of Hazara refugees who had fled Kabul. The Taliban threatened to blow up the Colossi when they captured Bamiyan, generating high-level protest from Buddhist communities in Japan and Sri Lanka. In the meantime, they had bombed the mountain above the Buddhas 8 times, creating more cracks in the sandstone niches that held the figures. The Hazara Jat had remained virtually independent until 1893, when it was conquered by the Pashtun king Abdul Rahman, who initiated the first anti-Hazara program, killing thousands of Hazaras, moving thousands more to Kabul, where they lived as indentured serfs and servants, and destroying their mosques. The estimated 3 to 4 million Hazaras are the largest Shia Muslim group in Afghanistan. The sectarian enmity between the Sunni Pashtuns and the Shia Hazaras went back a long way, but the Taliban had brought a new edge to the conflict, for they treated all Shias as munafiqeen or hypocrites and beyond the pale of true Islam. Even more irksome for the Taliban was that Hazara women were playing a significant political, social and even military role in the region's defence. The 80-member Central Council of the Hazara's Hizb-e-Wahadat party had 12 women members, many of them educated professionals. Women looked after UN aid programmes and Wahadat's efforts to provide basic literacy, health care and family planning. Women often fought in battle alongside their men. Some had killed Taliban in Mazar in May. Female professors who had fled Kabul had set up a university in Bamiyan, probably the poorest in the world, where classrooms were constructed with mud and straw, and there was no electricity or heating and few books. "We detest the Taliban. They are against all civilization, Afghan culture and women in particular. They have given Islam and Afghan people a bad name," Dr. Humair Arachi, who taught Persian literature at the university and had emerged as a leading poet of the resistance, told me. Nor did the Taliban appreciate Hazara women's style of dress. Dr. Arachi and her colleagues wore skirts and high-heeled boots. The poetry of Humair Arachi seemed to echo the Hazara's newfound confidence after centuries of oppression at the hands of the Pashtuns. "Victory is yours and God is with you, victorious army of Hazarajat. May your foes' chests be the target of your rifle barrels. You are the winner, the victorious. God is with you. My midnight prayers and my cries at dawn, and the children saying, 'O Lord, O Lord,' and the tears and sighs of the oppressed are with you." Despite the siege and decades of poor treatment and prejudice by the Pashtun rulers of Kabul, the Hazaras were now on a roll. They had been instrumental in defeating the Taliban in Mazar in May and again in October 1997. They'd also repulsed repeated Taliban attacks against Bamiyan. The Hazaras had once made up the third and weakest link in the Uzbek-Tajik-Hazara alliance confronting the Taliban. But now, with the Uzbeks divided and in disarray, and the Tajiks in a position of stalemate around Kabul, the Hazaras sensed that their time had come. "Our backs are to the Hindu Kush, and before us are the Taliban and their supporters, Pakistan. We will die, but we will never surrender," Qurban Ali Irfani, the defiant deputy chief of Wahadat, told me, as we sat trying to warm ourselves in front of a log fire in a room that overlooked the Buddhas, spectacularly draped in moonlight. There was a newfound confidence and pride in their organisation and their fighting prowess. "We saved the north from the Taliban," said Ahmed Sher, a 14-year-old Hazara soldier who'd already seen 2 years of battle and held his Kalashnikov like a professional soldier. The Hazaras were not without friends. Iran was flying in military supplies to a newly constructed 2-mile-long landing strip outside Bamiyan, and Karim Khalili, the leader of Wahadat, spent the winter visiting Tehran, Moscow, New Delhi and Ankara, looking for more military aid. But the Hazaras had also overstretched themselves. There were several factions amongst them, all competing for territory, influence and foreign aid. Separate factions of Hizb-e-Wahadat each controlled a part of Mazar, and they fought each other as well as the Uzbeks, turning Mazar into a war zone and the anti-Taliban alliance into a political shambles. Iranian and Russian intelligence officers made several attempts at mediating between Dostum, who was then based in Shibergan, and the Hazaras, as well as between the Hazara factions, but no side would compromise. In February 1998, as heavy fighting erupted inside Mazar between the Uzbeks and the Hazaras, Massoud paid his first visit to Tehran to try and persuade the Iranians to do something to save the anti-Taliban alliance before it was too late. Meanwhile, the Taliban sat out the winter, watching their enemies tear each other apart, while tightening the siege around Bamiyan and preparing for another attack on Mazar. Fighting continued through the winter months in the western province of Faryab, where the Taliban carried out another massacre in January, this time of some 600 Uzbek villagers. Western aid workers, who later investigated the incident, said civilians were dragged from their homes, lined up, and gunned down. International censure against the Taliban's policies escalated as they imposed ever stricter Islamic laws and punishments in Kabul. The public amputation of limbs, lashings, stoning of women, and executions became weekly events in Kabul and Kandahar. International Women's Day on the 8th of February 1998 was dedicated to the plight of Afghan women under Taliban rule. A hearing in the US Senate on the Afghan gender issue attracted widespread publicity, as did condemnation of the Taliban's policies by such luminaries as Hillary Clinton. The Taliban issued new edicts, stipulating the exact length of beards for males and a list of Muslim names with which newborn children had to be named. The Taliban shut down the few home schools for girls that were operating in Kabul, as the religious police went on a rampage, forcing all women off the streets of Kabul and insisting that householders blackened their windows so women would not be visible from the outside. Women were now forced to spend all their time indoors where not even sunlight could penetrate. Taliban hardliners were determined to force the UN aid agencies out of Afghanistan, and they provoked a number of incidents that tested UN patience to the limit. On the 24th of February 1998, all UN staff pulled out of Kandahar and halted aid operations there after senior Taliban leaders beat up UN staff and threatened them. Mullah Mohammad Hassan, the usually mild-mannered one-legged governor of Kandahar, threw a table and a chair at the head of one UN official and then tried to throttle him because he'd refused to pave a road in Hassan's village. In March, the Taliban refused to allow Alfredo Vitsky-Chestari, the head of UN humanitarian aid operations, to visit Kabul for talks. And the UN remained deeply frustrated by the Taliban's siege of the Hazarajat. In the north there is complete insecurity for our aid operations, and in the south we have a hell of a horrible time working with the Taliban. In the north there is no authority, and in the south there is a very difficult authority, Lakhdar Brahimi told me. Despite these problems, Brahimi attempted to set up a meeting between the Taliban and the anti-Taliban alliance. Anxious to avoid meeting the opposition's leaders and thereby give them further legitimacy, the Taliban suggested a meeting of ulema from both sides. For several months they squabbled with each other as to who qualified to be an ulema. The UN mustered the help of the US. Bill Richardson, President Clinton's foreign policy troubleshooter and the US ambassador to the UN, visited Afghanistan for a day of parachute diplomacy on the 17th of April 1998, and persuaded both sides to convene the ulema meeting. Both sides were trying to woo the US, and the flamboyant Richardson received a rapturous reception. He was deluged with gifts of carpets, saddlebags, and turbans. In Kabul, the Taliban allowed the accompanying US TV crews to film their leaders for the first time, and as a courtesy to Richardson, they postponed their regular Friday public spectacle of lashings and amputations in the city's football stadium. But although the Taliban leaders in Kabul promised to ease the siege of Hazarajat and discuss their gender policies with the UN, Mullah Omar rejected the agreement just a few hours after Richardson left. The ulema met in Islamabad under UN auspices at the end of April, and after 4 days of talks, each side agreed to nominate 20 ulema to a peace commission, which would decide on such issues as a ceasefire, lifting the Taliban siege on the Hazarajat, and an exchange of prisoners. However, the Taliban then refused to nominate their delegation, and by May another peace process had collapsed, even as the Taliban prepared a fresh offensive. Part of these preparations involved a fresh escalation with the UN. In June, the Taliban stopped all women from attending general hospitals and ordered all female Muslim UN staff travelling to Afghanistan to be chaperoned by a mihram or a blood relative, an impossible demand to meet, especially as UN agencies had increased the number of Muslim female aid workers precisely so as to satisfy Taliban demands and gain access to Afghan women. The Taliban then insisted that all NGOs working in Kabul move out of their offices and relocate to the destroyed building of the Polytechnic College. 22 out of 30 NGOs voted to pull out of Kabul if the Taliban did not retract their demand, but the Taliban said the issue was non-negotiable. As the EU suspended all humanitarian aid to areas under Taliban control, Brahimi dropped a bombshell by going public on the UN's frustration. "This is an organisation that hands out edicts to us that prevents us from doing our job," he said. "The Taliban must know that not only is there a limit to what you can stand, but there are growing pressures on us, in particular from the donor community, to say that there's a limit." The Taliban refused to relent, and on the 20th of July 1998 they closed down all NGO offices by force, and an exodus of foreign aid workers from Kabul began. The same day, the bodies of two Afghans working for UN aid agencies, Mohammed Habibi of UNHCR and Mohammed Bahsavar of WFP, who had been kidnapped earlier, were found in Jalalabad. The Taliban offered no explanation for their deaths. With more than half of Kabul's 1.2 million people benefiting in some way from NGO handouts, women and children were immediate victims when aid was cut off. Food distribution, health care, and the city's fragile water distribution network were all seriously affected. As people waved empty kettles and buckets at passing Taliban jeeps, their reply to the population was characteristic of their lack of social concern. "We Muslims believe God the Almighty will feed everybody one way or another. If the foreign NGOs leave, then it is your decision. We have not expelled them," Planning Minister Karidin Mohammed insisted. Meanwhile, the Taliban had persuaded Pakistan and Saudi Arabia to back them in another offensive to take the north. Saudi intelligence chief Prince Turki Al-Faisal visited Kandahar in mid-June, after which the Saudis provided the Taliban with 400 pickup trucks and financial aid. Pakistan's ISI had prepared a budget of some 2 billion rupees, $5 million, for logistical support that was needed by the Taliban. ISI officers visited Kandahar frequently to help the Taliban prepare the attack, as thousands of new Afghan and Pakistani recruits from refugee camps and madrasas arrived to enlist with the Taliban. Meanwhile, in March, Iran, Russia and Uzbekistan began to pour weapons, ammunition and fuel into the anti-Taliban alliance. While Iran flew in plane loads of weapons to the Hazaras directly from Mashhad to Bamiyan, the Russians and Iranians provided Massoud with weapons at an airbase in Kuliab in southern Tajikistan, from where he transported them into Afghanistan. In July, the Taliban swept northwards from Herat, capturing Maimana on the 12th of July 1998 after routing Dostum's forces and capturing 100 tanks and vehicles and some 800 Uzbek soldiers, the majority of whom they massacred. On the 1st of August 1998, the Taliban captured Dostum's headquarters at Shibergan after several of his commanders accepted Taliban bribes and switched sides. Dostum fled to Uzbekistan and later to Turkey. Demoralised by Dostum's desertion, more Uzbek commanders guarding the western road into Mazar also accepted bribes, thereby exposing the 1,500-strong Hazara force just outside the city to a surprise Taliban attack. It came in the early hours of the 8th of August 1998, when the Hazara forces suddenly found themselves surrounded. They fought until their ammunition ran out and only 100 survived. By 10 a.m., the first Taliban pickups entered Mazar as an unsuspecting public was going about its daily business. What followed was another brutal massacre, genocidal in its ferocity, as the Taliban took revenge on their losses the previous year. A Taliban commander later said that Mullah Omar had given them permission to kill for 2 hours, but they had killed for 2 days. The Taliban went on a killing frenzy, driving their pickups up and down the narrow streets of Mazar, shooting to the left and right and killing everything that moved, shop owners, cart pullers, women and children shoppers, and even goats and donkeys. Contrary to all injunctions of Islam, which demands immediate burial, bodies were left to rot on the streets. "They were shooting without warning at everybody who happened to be on the street, without discriminating between men, women and children. Soon the streets were covered with dead bodies and blood. No one was allowed to bury the corpses for the first 6 days. Dogs were eating human flesh and going mad, and soon the smell became intolerable," said a male Tajik who managed to escape the massacre. As people ran for shelter to their homes, Taliban soldiers barged in and massacred Hazara households wholescale. People were shot 3 times on the spot, one bullet in the head, one in the chest and one in the testicles. Those who survived buried their dead in their gardens. Women were raped, said the same witness. "When the Taliban stormed into our house, they shot my husband and 2 brothers dead on the spot. Each was shot 3 times, and then their throats were slit in the halal way," said a 40-year-old Tajik widow. After the first full day of indiscriminate killing, the Taliban reverted to targeting the Hazaras. Unwilling to repeat their mistake the previous year, when they entered Mazar without guides, this time the Taliban had enlisted local Pashtuns, once loyal to Hikmatyar, who knew the city well. Over the next few days, these Pashtun fighters from Balkh guided Taliban search parties to the homes of Hazaras. But the Taliban were out of control, and arbitrary killings continued, even of those who were not Hazaras. "I saw that a young Tajik boy had been killed. The Talib was still standing there, and the father was crying, 'Why have you killed my son? We are Tajiks.' The Talib responded, 'Why didn't you say so?' And the father said, 'Did you ask that I could answer?'" Thousands of Hazaras were taken to Mazar jail, and when it was full, they were dumped in containers which were locked and the prisoners allowed to suffocate. Some containers were taken to the Dasht-e-Laili desert outside Mazar, and the inmates massacred there, in direct retaliation for the similar treatment meted out to the Taliban in 1997. They brought 3 containers from Mazar to Shibergan. When they opened the door of one truck, only 3 persons were alive. About 300 were dead. The 3 were taken to the jail. "I could see all this from where I was sitting," said another witness. As tens of thousands of civilians tried to escape Mazar by foot in long columns over the next few days, the Taliban killed dozens more in aerial bombardments. The Taliban aimed to cleanse the north of the Shia. Mullah Niazi, the commander who had ordered Najibullah's murder, was appointed governor of Mazar, and within hours of taking the city, Taliban mullahs were proclaiming from the city's mosques that the city's Shia had 3 choices: convert to Sunni Islam, leave for Shia Iran, or die. All prayer services conducted by the Shia in mosques were banned. "Last year you rebelled against us and killed us. From all your homes you shot at us. Now we're here to deal with you. The Hazaras are not Muslims, and now we have to kill Hazaras. You either accept to be Muslims or leave Afghanistan. Wherever you go, we will catch you. If you go up, we will pull you down by your feet. If you hide below, we will pull you up by your hair," Niazi declared from Mazar's central mosque. As the Roman historian Tacitus said of the Roman conquest of Britain, the Roman army created a desolation and called it peace. With no independent observers around to do a body count, it was impossible to estimate the numbers killed, but the UN and the ICRC later estimated that between 5,000 and 6,000 people were killed. It subsequently became clear that along the route of the Taliban advance, similar massacres of Uzbeks and Tajiks had taken place in Maimana and Shibergan. My own estimate is that as many as between 6,000 and 8,000 civilians were killed in July and August, including the heavy casualties among the anti-Taliban troops. But the Taliban's aim to terrorize the population so that they would not rise against them later was to remain unfulfilled. The Taliban were to target one more group in Mazar that was to bring down a storm of international protest and plunge them into near war with Iran. A small Taliban unit, led by Mullah Dost Mohammed and including several Pakistani militants of the anti-Shia Sipah-e-Sahaba party, entered the Iranian consulate in Mazar, herded 11 Iranian diplomats, intelligence officers and a journalist into the basement, and then shot them dead. Tehran had earlier contacted the Pakistan government to guarantee the security of their consulate, because the Iranians knew that ISI officers had driven into Mazar with the Taliban. The Iranians had thought that Dost Mohammed's unit had been sent to protect them, and so had welcomed them at first. The Taliban had also captured 45 Iranian truck drivers who had been ferrying arms to the Hazaras. At first, the Taliban refused to admit the whereabouts of the diplomats. But then, as international protests and Iranian fury increased, they admitted that the diplomats had been killed, not on official orders, but by renegade Taliban. But reliable sources said that Dost Mohammed had spoken to Mullah Omar on his wireless to ask whether the diplomats should be killed, and Omar had given the go-ahead. True or not, the Iranians certainly believed this. Ironically, Dost Mohammed later wound up in jail in Kandahar because he had brought back two Hazara concubines, and his wife in Kandahar complained to Mullah Omar. Some 400 Hazara women were kidnapped and taken as concubines by the Taliban. It was the Taliban victory, their control over most of Afghanistan, and their expectation, fueled by Pakistani officials, that they would now receive international recognition, which partly prompted their guest, the Saudi dissident Osama bin Laden, to become bolder in his declared jihad against the US and the Saudi royal family. On the 7th of August 1998, bin Laden's sympathizers blew up the US embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, killing 224 people and wounding 4,500. This prompted the US to launch missile strikes on bin Laden's training camps in northeastern Afghanistan on the 20th of August 1998. Dozens of cruise missiles hit six targets, killing over 20 people and wounding 30 more. The US claimed that bin Laden had been present but escaped the attack. In fact, there were few Arab casualties. Most of those killed were Pakistanis and Afghans who were training to fight in India-controlled Kashmir. The Taliban were outraged and organized demonstrations in Afghan cities to protest against the attacks. UN offices in several towns were attacked by mobs. Mullah Omar emerged to blast Clinton personally. "If the attack on Afghanistan is Clinton's personal decision, then he has done it to divert the world and the American people's attention from that shameful White House affair that has proved Clinton is a liar and a man devoid of decency and honour," Omar said, in reference to the Monica Lewinsky affair. Omar insisted that bin Laden was a guest, not just of the Taliban, but of the people of Afghanistan, and that the Taliban would never hand him over to the US. "America itself is the biggest terrorist in the world," Omar added. As UN officials evacuated Kabul because of growing insecurity, gunmen shot dead an Italian UN military officer and wounded a French diplomat. The two killers, Haq Nawaz and Salim, both from Rawalpindi, whom the Taliban apprehended and jailed, were both Pakistani Islamic militants from the Harkat-ul-Ansar group. Instead of trying to placate their international critics and Iran, the Taliban launched an offensive from three directions on Bamiyan, which fell on the 13th of September 1998 after some Hazara commanders surrendered to the Taliban. Karim Khalili and other Wahadat leaders, together with much of the population of the town, took to the hills as the first Taliban troops entered. This time, due to repeated international appeals to respect human rights, Mullah Omar ordered his troops to restrain themselves against Hazara civilians. Nevertheless, killings did take place in Bamiyan a few weeks after the Taliban entered. In one village near Bamiyan, 50 old men, who were left behind after the younger population escaped, were killed by the Taliban. In another tragedy, on the 18th of September, just 5 days after they occupied Bamiyan, Taliban fighters dynamited the head of the small Buddha colossus, blowing its face away. They fired rockets at the Buddha's groin, damaging the luxurious folds of the figure and destroying the intricate frescoes in the niche where the statue stood. The two Buddhas, Afghanistan's greatest archaeological heritage, had stood for nearly 2,000 years and had withstood the assault of the Mongols. Now the Taliban were destroying them. It was a crime that could not be justified by any appeals to Islam. For the Iranians, the fall of Bamiyan was the last straw. Iran said it had the right of self-defense under international law and the UN Charter to take all necessary action against the Taliban, exactly the same argument used by Washington for its missile strike. A week later, Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khomeini, warned of a huge war which could engulf the entire region. He accused Pakistan of using troops and aircraft in the capture of Bamiyan, which was denied by Islamabad. Iran-Pakistan relations sunk to a new low as Tehran flexed its muscles. 70,000 Iranian Revolutionary Guards, backed by tanks and aircraft, began the largest military exercises ever along the Iran-Afghanistan border. In October, some 200,000 regular Iranian troops began another series of exercises along the border as the Taliban mobilized some 5,000 fighters to prevent an expected Iranian invasion. As the UN Security Council expressed fears of an all-out Iranian attack, it sent Lakhdar Brahimi back to the region. The military tensions between Iran and the Taliban only subsided when Brahimi met with Mullah Omar in Kandahar on the 14th of October 1998. It was the first time that Omar had ever met with a UN official or foreign diplomat who was not Pakistani. Omar agreed to release all the Iranian truck drivers, return the dead bodies of the Iranian diplomats, and promised to improve relations with the UN. The Taliban's confrontation with Iran had given Massoud the time and space to regroup his forces and the remaining Uzbek and Hazara fighters who had not surrendered. At the same time, increased arms supplies, including vehicles and helicopters, reached him from Russia and Iran. Massoud launched a series of well-coordinated lightning attacks in the northeast, capturing a huge swath of territory back from the Taliban, especially along Afghanistan's sensitive border with Tajikistan and Uzbekistan. There were some 2,000 Taliban casualties during October and November as the demoralized, poorly supplied and cold Taliban garrisons fought briefly and then surrendered to Massoud. On the 7th of December 1998, Massoud held a meeting of all field commanders opposed to the Taliban in the Panjshir Valley. The collapse of the Hazara and Uzbek leadership had left Massoud and his Tajiks supreme, and the commanders, who included several prominent Pashtuns, appointed Massoud as the military commander of all anti-Taliban forces. The Taliban offensive, the massacre of Hazaras and the confrontation with Iran, along with a US cruise missile attack, dramatically undermined the fragile balance of power in the region. The Taliban's clean sweep also infuriated Russia, Turkey and the Central Asian states, who blamed Pakistan and Saudi Arabia for backing the Taliban. The sharpened war of words increased the regional polarization between the two blocks of states. The foreign and defense ministers of Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan and Tajikistan and Russian officials met in Tashkent on the 25th of August 1998 to coordinate joint military and political plans to halt the Taliban advance. The consequences of the regional escalation were enormous. There was the danger of a war between Iran and the Taliban, which could also suck in Pakistan on the side of the Taliban. Western investors and oil companies became wary of further investments in the oil-rich Caspian nations. The danger of Islamic fundamentalism spreading to the already economically impoverished Central Asian states increased, and anti-US feeling across the region escalated. Pakistan became more deeply polarized as Islamic parties demanded Islamicization. The international community remained frustrated with the Taliban's intransigence in refusing to form a broad-based government, change its stance on the gender issue, and accept diplomatic norms of behavior. UN aid agencies were unable to return to Kabul. Washington was now obsessed with bin Laden's capture and the Taliban's refusal to hand him over. Even close ally Saudi Arabia, which felt insulted by the protection that the Taliban were giving bin Laden, pulled out its diplomatic representation in Kabul and ceased all official funding for the Taliban, leaving Pakistan as their sole provider. These international frustrations resulted, on the 8th of December 1998, in the toughest UN Security Council resolution on Afghanistan to date. The resolution threatened unspecified sanctions against the Taliban for harbouring international terrorists, violating human rights, promoting drugs trafficking, and refusing to accept a ceasefire. Afghanistan-based terrorism has become a plague, said US envoy Nancy Soderberg. Pakistan was the only country that did not support the resolution, calling it biased. And by now, Pakistan was as internationally isolated as the Taliban. Increasing pressure by the UN, the US, and other states forced both sides back to the negotiating table in early 1999. Under UN auspices, delegations from the Taliban and the opposition met for talks in Ashgabat on the 11th of March 1999. The talks ended on a hopeful note, with both sides agreeing to exchange prisoners and continue negotiating. But by April, Mullah Omar ruled out further talks, accusing Massoud of duplicity. In fact, both sides had used the lull and the talks to prepare for a renewed spring offensive. On the 7th of April 1999, Massoud met with the Russian Defence Minister Igor Sergeyev in Dushanbe, as Russia announced it would build a new military base in Tajikistan. Clearly part of its role would be to step up military aid to Massoud. The Taliban were re-equipping themselves and recruiting more students from Pakistani madrasas. Massoud and the Hazaras launched a series of attacks in the northeast and the Hazarajat. In a dramatic reversal, Wahdat troops recaptured Bamiyan on the 21st of April 1999. The north was once again in flames as fighting spread and UN peacemaking efforts were back to zero. At the beginning of 1998, Kofi Annan had warned, "In a country of 20 million people, 50,000 armed men are holding the whole population hostage." By the end of 1998, Annan spoke ominously of the prospect of a deeper regionalization of the conflict, where Afghanistan had become the stage for a new version of the Great Game. Rather than bring peace, the Taliban victories and their massacres of the peoples of the north had only brought Afghanistan even closer to the edge of ethnic fragmentation. Annan's dire predictions appeared to be borne out by the end of the year when UN mediator Lakhdar Brahimi announced his resignation. He blamed the Taliban for their intransigence, the support given to them by thousands of Pakistani madrasa students, and continued outside interference. His resignation in October followed two Taliban offensives in July and September, which attempted to push Massoud's forces out of the Kabul region and cut off his supply links with Tajikistan in the north. Both offensives failed, but the Taliban conducted a bloody scorched-earth policy north of the capital, which led to some 200,000 people fleeing the area and the devastation of the Shamali Valley, one of the most fertile regions in the country. As winter set in, tens of thousands of refugees who had taken shelter with Massoud's forces in the Panjshir Valley and with the Taliban in Kabul faced acute shortages of food and shelter. Brahimi's resignation was followed by a much tougher reaction against the Taliban by the international community. The UN Security Council unanimously imposed limited sanctions on the Taliban on the 15th of October, banning commercial aircraft flights to and from Afghanistan and freezing Taliban bank accounts worldwide, even as Washington stepped up pressure on the Taliban to hand over bin Laden. On the 6th of February 2000, the Taliban came under renewed international pressure after distraught Afghan civilians hijacked an Afghan Airlines passenger plane and flew it to London where they asked for asylum. The hijacking ended peacefully 4 days later. In early March 2000, the Taliban launched abortive offensives against Massoud's forces but were pushed back. The Taliban received a major blow to their prestige when two top NA leaders, who had spent 3 years in a Taliban jail, escaped on the 27th of March and arrived in Iran. They included Ismail Khan, who had led the Mujahideen resistance against Soviet occupying forces in the 1980s and then fought the Taliban. In April, the Taliban issued several appeals to the international community to help victims from a drought in three southern provinces and from a locust plague in Baghlan province. The drought worsened, affecting the entire country. But the Taliban's refusal to announce a ceasefire discouraged international aid. After 3 months, UN agencies had received only $8 million out of $67 million for a drought appeal. As the drought worsened, prices for foodstuffs rose by more than 75%, and the Afghani currency lost 50% of its value. This did not stop the Taliban from launching an offensive on the 1st of July. Thousands of Taliban troops and dozens of tanks tried to blast their way through NA positions just 30 kilometers north of Kabul. However, the Taliban lost 400 men as they were repelled by Massoud's forces. As fighting subsided around Kabul, the Taliban launched an offensive on the 28th of July in a bid to cut Massoud's supply lines with Tajikistan. They carried out intensive bombings of civilian targets and slowly made headway towards Talukan, the political headquarters of the NA. After a four-week siege and heavy fighting, and after Massoud conducted a strategic withdrawal from the city to prevent civilian casualties, Talukan fell on the 5th of September. Massoud withdrew to the borders of Badakhshan, the last province under his control, as 150,000 refugees fled to the border with Tajikistan. The Taliban also captured several towns on the Afghanistan-Tajikistan border, creating a wave of panic in Central Asia. Throughout 2000, there were growing signs of dissent within the Taliban leadership, while the tribal Pashtuns demonstrated growing resentment against the strictures and corruption of Taliban rule and against the Taliban's lack of consideration for the suffering population. On the 13th of January, the money market in Kabul was robbed by its Taliban guards, who stole the equivalent of $200,000. The money market shut down in protest for several days as the Afghani plummeted against the US dollar. On the 25th of January, 400 tribal leaders from four eastern provinces forced the Taliban to replace local governors. They protested the conscription drive by the Taliban and the sharp rise in taxes, money that was being sent to Kabul rather than being used for local relief. On the 27th of January, over 2,000 people held an unprecedented anti-Taliban rally in Khost. The drought and the Taliban's insistence on continued fighting increased public criticism. Smugglers and transporters blamed the Taliban for harboring bin Laden, which had led to UN sanctions and a cutback in the smuggling trade. In late April, the Taliban arrested the head of its air force, General Akhtar Mansouri, and 10 other officials for helping Ismail Khan escape. There was also increasing hostility from neighbouring countries to the Taliban's expanding support to Islamic fundamentalist and terrorist movements. The Taliban were playing host to extremist groups from Central Asia, Iran, Kashmir, China and Pakistan. The Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, IMU, which in 1999 and again in 2000 launched abortive offensives against Uzbekistan's regime, has bases in northern Afghanistan. More than one-third of the 15,000-strong Taliban force that captured Talukan was made up of non-Afghans, which included 3,000 Pakistani militants, 1,000 fighters from the IMU, and several hundred Arabs under bin Laden, among others. International efforts by the US, Russia, and the regional states to coordinate anti-terrorism measures were stepped up. Russia's accusations against the Taliban increased dramatically after Kabul recognized the government of the breakaway Republic of Chechnya and allowed the Chechens to open an embassy in Kabul on the 16th of January 2000. After the military coup in Islamabad on the 12th of October 1999, Pakistan stepped up its support to the Taliban, providing increased military for its summer offensive in 2000. Pakistan remained the only country in the world supporting the Taliban, and countries in the region became more hostile to the military regime. Several attempts by the UN and Organization of the Islamic Conference, the OIC, to bring the warring factions to the negotiating table failed. Francesc Vendrell, a Spanish diplomat, was appointed as the new UN Secretary-General's special representative to Afghanistan on the 18th of January. In March, and again in May, the OIC organized indirect talks between the Taliban and the NA in Jeddah, with no outcome. Even as they appeared to be winning control of the entire country, the Taliban remained internationally isolated and condemned as a pariah movement by all of Afghanistan's neighbours.
Part 2. Islam and the Taliban. Chapter 6. Challenging Islam, the New Style Fundamentalism of the Taliban. Islam has always been at the very centre of the lives of ordinary Afghan people, whether it is saying one's prayers 5 times a day, fasting in Ramadan, or giving zakat, an Islamic contribution to the poor. Few Muslim peoples in the world observe the rituals and the piety of Islam with such regularity and emotion as the Afghans. Islam has been the bedrock for the unity of Afghanistan's diverse and multi-ethnic peoples, while jihad has frequently provided the principal mobilizing factor for Afghan nationalism during the resistance against the British and the Russians. Rich or poor, communist, king or mujahideen, it makes little difference. When I met with the aging ex-king Zahir Shah in Rome in 1988, he quietly interrupted the interview so he could go into the next room to pray. Communist ministers prayed in their offices. Mujahideen warriors would break off from fighting to pray. Mullah Omar spends hours on his prayer mat, often doing much of his strategic thinking after his prayers. Ahmad Shah Massoud leads breaks from directing a battle to pray, and then goes into a deep spiritual silence as booming guns and wireless chatter fill the air. But no Afghan can insist that the fellow Muslim standing next to him prays also. Traditionally, Islam in Afghanistan has been immensely tolerant to other Muslim sects, other religions, and modern lifestyles. Afghan mullahs were never known to push Islam down people's throats, and sectarianism was not a political issue until recently. Until 1992, Hindus, Sikhs, and Jews played a significant role in the country's economy. Traditionally, they controlled the money market in urban centres, and when Afghan kings went to war, they often borrowed money from them. After 1992, the brutal civil war destroyed this age-old Afghan tolerance and consensus. The civil war has divided Islamic sects and ethnic groups in a way that before was unimaginable to ordinary Afghans. Massoud's massacre of the Hazaras in Kabul in 1995, the Hazaras' massacre of the Taliban in Mazar in 1997, and the Taliban massacres of Hazaras and Uzbeks in 1998 has no precedent in Afghan history, and perhaps has irreparably damaged the fabric of the country's national and religious soul. The Taliban's deliberate anti-Shia program has denigrated Islam and the unity of the country as minority groups tried to flee the country en masse. For the first time in Afghanistan's history, the unifying factor of Islam has become a lethal weapon in the hands of extremists, a force for division, fragmentation, and enormous bloodletting. 80% of Afghans belong to the Sunni Hanafi sect, the most liberal of the four Sunni schools of thought. The minority sects were few and scattered along the fringes of the country. Shia Islam is predominant amongst the Hazaras in the Hazarajat, a handful of Pashtun tribes, a few Tajik clans, and some Herates. The Ismailis, the followers of the Aga Khan, follow a branch of Shiism. They've always lived in the inaccessible northeast, contiguous to the Ismaili communities in the Pamir Mountains, which today constitute eastern Tajikistan and Pakistan's northern areas. The Afghan Ismaili leader Syed Nadir Shah Hussein, who died in 1971, was made head of the community by the Aga Khan. His sons have led the Ismaili community since then, playing a prominent role in the anti-Taliban alliance. Hindus and Sikhs, who arrived with the British as camp followers in the 19th century, had mostly left the country by 1998, as had the Bukharan Jews, although a few dozen remained. The Sunni Hanafi creed is essentially non-hierarchical and decentralized, which has made it difficult for the 20th century rulers to incorporate its religious leaders into strong, centralized state systems. But for centuries, this admirably suited the loose Afghan confederation. Traditional Islam in Afghanistan believed in minimum government, where state interference was as little and as far away as possible. Everyday decisions were carried out by the tribe and the community. Amongst the Pashtuns, village mullahs, although largely uneducated, ensured that the mosque was the centre of village life. Students, or talibs, studied at the small madrasas that were scattered through the tribal areas. In medieval times, Herat was the centre of Afghanistan's madrasa system. But from the 17th century, Afghan scholars travelled to Central Asia, Egypt and India to study at more renowned madrasas in order to join the ranks of the ulama. Islam was also deeply rooted in Afghanistan because Sharia law governed the legal process until 1925, when King Amanullah first began to introduce a civil legal code and the state took on the role of training ulema to become qazis, Islamic judges. In 1946, a Sharia faculty was set up in Kabul University, which became the main centre for integrating the new civil code with the Sharia. This merging of the traditional with the modern was epitomised by Mohammad Musa Shafiq, the last prime minister under the monarchy, which was overthrown in 1973. Shafiq studied at a madrasa and at the Sharia faculty in Kabul, and then went on to take another degree from Columbia University in New York. When he was executed by the communists in 1979, his death was widely mourned. Thus, it was not surprising that in 1979 the mullahs did not join the radical Islamic Mujahideen parties, but the more traditional tribal-based parties such as Harakat Inqilabi Islami, headed by Maulana Mohammed Nabi Mohammadi, and Hizb-e Islami, led by Maulvi Yunis Khalis. Both men were Maulvis who had studied for a time at the Haqqaniya Madrasa in Pakistan and then established their own madrasas inside Afghanistan. After the Soviet invasion, they set up loose organisations which were decentralised, unideological and non-hierarchical, but they rapidly lost out as the CIA-ISI arms pipeline supported the more radical Islamic parties. Another moderating factor for Islam in Afghanistan was the enormous popularity of Sufism, the trend of mystical Islam which originated in Central Asia and Persia. Sufi means wool in Arabic, and the name comes from the rough woolen coats worn by the early Sufi brethren. The Sufi orders, or tariqa, which means the way, was a medieval reaction against authority, intellectualism, the law, and the mullah, and thus immensely appealing for poor, powerless people. The Sufis build their faith on prayer, contemplation, dances, music, and sessions of physical shaking or whirling in a permanent quest for truth. These rituals create an inner spiritual space within man that the outsider cannot penetrate. 7 centuries ago, the famous Arab traveller Ibn Battuta described Sufism, "The fundamental aim of the Sufi life was to pierce the veils of human sense which shut man off from the divine, and so to obtain communion and absorption into God." The 2 main Sufi orders in Afghanistan of Naqshbandiya and Qadariya played a major role in uniting the anti-Soviet resistance, as they provided a network of associations and alliances outside the Mujahideen parties and ethnic groups. Leaders of these orders were equally prominent. The Mujaddedi family were leaders of the Naqshbandiya order and had been kingmakers in Kabul for centuries. In a brutal act, the communists killed 79 members of the Mujaddedi family in Kabul in January 1979 to eliminate potential rivals. Nevertheless, one survivor, Sibghatullah Mujaddedi, set up his own resistance party in Peshawar, the Jabhat-e-Najat Milli Afghanistan, National Liberation Front of Afghanistan, and became a fierce critic of the radical Islamic parties. He was appointed president of the Afghan Interim Government in 1989 and then became the first Mujahideen president of Afghanistan in 1992. Pir Sayed Ahmad Gailani, the head of the Qadariya order and related to ex-King Zahir Shah through marriage, set up the Mahaz-e-Mili National Islamic Front of Afghanistan in Peshawar. Both leaders were supporters of Zahir Shah and remained the most moderate of all the Mujahideen leaders. They were also sidelined by the CIA-ISI nexus and by Hikmatyar and Massoud and later by the Taliban. They returned to politics in 1999 by setting up a new Peace and National Unity Party that attempted to mediate between the Taliban and their opponents. Before the Taliban, Islamic extremism had never flourished in Afghanistan. Within the Sunni tradition were the Wahhabis, followers of the strict and austere Wahhabi creed of Saudi Arabia. Begun by Abdul Wahhab, 1703 to 1792, as a movement to cleanse the Arab Bedouin from the influence of Sufism, the spread of Wahhabism became a major plank in Saudi foreign policy after the oil boom in the 1970s.